This week on the BOAG World Show, we ask whether the digital agency is on the decline as more organisations build their own in-house teams. This week's show is sponsored by Videoblox and Vivaldi. Welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast for all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG, and joining me on this week's show is Andy Clark, Drew McClellan, Sam Barnes and Marcus Lillington, and lots of alcohol.
Hello.
Because it was, Drew, well, you made the mistake of saying you've got gin and tea. Gin and tea?
Yeah.
And then we all went off and got a drink, because it's a Friday afternoon, we're all tired.
Oh. You see, I've got a cup of coffee, and it's decaf, and yet I'm looking over at my wife's desk, and she has a bottle of sloe gin on it.
Very nice. Well, that's not surprising. She has to live with you.
It's the only way she gets through the day.
Ah, oh, God, that's good.
Clanking ice cubes.
There. Ooh.
Very nice.
What have you got, Marcus?
I've got a G&T as well.
See, I couldn't do a G&T quick enough, so I've just got wine.
Drew, so gin comparison, what have you got in yours?
I think I've got the Botanist.
Oh,
very nice.
Lovely.
Fever Tree Tonic.
I've got Fever Tree Tonic and Tanqueray. Very nice.
We've got this kind of, I don't know, late evening vibe going. Just kind of reached the point in the evening where we're just chilling
in
out.
The study.
Chatting. I'm in my smoking jacket.
There you go, yeah.
By a roaring fire.
I could put some music, some gentle jazzy tunes behind us.
That's all we need.
And a fire going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crackling in the background.
Just a crackling background noise. That'd be perfect. I miss having an open fire. That's what happens when you live in a 1970s shithole.
Hey, I'm from Slough here, not you.
No, seriously, people have got, it's funny, I don't know about you, but I have certain mental images about where people live. It's like when we went to see John Hicks, Andy, we went up there, didn't we? And that was the first time I'd been to his place. And it wasn't at all like I thought it was. And people never imagine where I live, because everybody thinks, oh, Paul lives out in the country, which I do. But I live in an end of terrace 1970s house with white plastic cladding on the front of it.
Nice.
It's disgusting.
Is it asbestos lined?
Yes, which is why it hasn't been taken off.
I'm surprised that you still have the house and that you just don't travel around the country in your motorhome.
Well, we've considered it. But I don't think my teenage son would ever forgive me. Mainly because he would be completely lacking decent internet connectivity, which would make him cry like a girl. So there you go.
Do girls cry particularly hard when they have no internet?
Well, judging by my wife, yes. I tell you, whenever the internet, because I've been rewiring my office. And so I've got this dodgy cable that runs from the router in my office through to the lounge where the Wi-Fi is. And every time I knock this router, right, the Wi-Fi goes down. And it's like I've murdered a kitten in front of them. It's just horrendous. Can't survive without it.
I reckon Andy lives in a castle, a Welsh castle.
No, he lives in a... Don't you live in some kind of falling down cottage or you know, barny thing?
Well, it doesn't fall down anymore. But, no, we live in what used to be four quarry workers' cottages, dating back about 300 years, and...
Four of them? That's a bit greedy, isn't it?
Well, no, because they were just like one up and one down back in the time when all you had was, you know, 18 children and a sheep in your Welsh cottage. Nothing much changes. And then sort of turn of the 20th century, they knocked it all together into one house. And we've been slowly doing it up over the last 20 years.
But please tell me it's the end of a dirt track road where and sheep wander through your garden regularly.
No, I have had a cow in our front garden once. No word of a lie. And we have had horses kind of parked outside. But no, we live opposite a pub at the end of a lane in a village. So it's not that remote, no.
But the opposite a pub bit sounds good.
Very no,
good.
We never go in. No.
What? Oh, why?
No, we never go in. Well, but it's not... I shouldn't really slag off the local pub, should I? on a podcast listened to by millions.
Yeah, but you're talking about a community in North Wales. The chance of them listening to this podcast, I imagine, would be fairly slim.
I don't know. Yes. One of them is on it.
Well, yeah, well, that's true. Yeah.
Yes. Well, now you see, you do yourself an injustice, Paul. You know, you forget how wide your reputation has spread. I can remember. And this is going back about 10 years now. Me and you and a bunch of other people, maybe even Drew, being on a tube train in London.
It was John Hicks.
Oh, it was Hicks, was it? Yeah. And we were on a tube train in London. You were just gassing, as is your normal wont. And some random bloke got up and said, "Excuse me, you're not Paul Boag, are you?" And he'd recognise your voice on the tube.
I remember it very well because at first he just goes, "Excuse me." And I thought, oh, somebody begging on the tube. And then he says, "Are you Paul Boag?" And I think, where's he read that on my clothes? Because obviously my wife sews my name into all my clothes for when I lose them. Yeah, he did. It did happen. The funniest one, mine was...
He was begging you to stop talking, probably.
Yeah, probably. I had that once on a train. A woman came up to me and said, "This is supposed to be the quiet carriage." I was just having a normal conversation for me. And also once somebody came up to me outside Thorpe Park. I was taking my youth group to Thorpe Park, and a guy came up to me and said, "Oh, you're Paul Boag, aren't you?" The youth group pissed themselves with laughter. They thought that was the funniest thing in the world. So there you go.
Internet famous Paul Boag.
Yeah. Well, not as famous as you, Marcus.
No, I'm not internet famous. You're internet famous.
Well, yeah. Maybe no.
I did get. I remember once, many many years ago, decades ago, we'd done a breakfast TV show in America. I think it was in New York, and we were walking back to our hotel, and a bus full of school kids went past, all hanging out the window, going, "Yo, breathe, man," which was kind of one of those things.
But surely that must have happened quite a lot.
It did out there, not over here, but didn't get recognised much here.
Drew, are you recognised a lot? Are you recognised, you know, for your internet fame?
No. Well, I mean, only... No. No. Rachel is more than I am.
Well, yeah, that's true.
She is sometimes approached in shopping centres and the like.
But don't you think we've kind of reached the point where we're the... has been generation of web designers that everybody's forgetting.
Yeah, I definitely hope so. Mm. I mean, it'd be terrible if it was just always the same people for 10, 15 years and there's nobody new coming up and doing new and exciting things. I mean, I'm done doing new and exciting things. I want to do the same old things I've always done and be very unexcited by it.
Yeah, I'm not somebody with any ambition, really.
This is so inspiring.
But yeah, I'm just thinking, really, I've got a plan. I've just had a plan. Just sitting here with the jazz playing in the background and the roaring fire, I'm thinking we need an old people's home for retired web designers.
Fund.
Yeah, we could all just retire to a big stately home somewhere.
Before it got dangerous, I used to think about, I used to dream about sort of retiring to North Africa and being one of those kind of like old colonial men that would just spend their time. I'd have a manservant and I'd live in a little place above a market and I'd be an alcoholic, obviously.
Yeah.
Just sit there drinking, I don't know what alcoholics drink.
We could all move to India. That's the thing to do, isn't it? You retire to India. And I have to say, after going there, I could imagine that, you know, just getting a nice house and just getting a load of people to you know, look after me. You know, it's great.
Feed you grapes, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, Marcus, you must be planning this now. You're only a couple of years away, aren't you?
Well, that would mean that Andy's a year ahead of me, obviously. I have to make that point.
Well, we're not going to talk about being old again. I was in a workshop with Mr. Joe Leach doing a psychology for web designers workshop yesterday. And every time he talked about over 50s life insurance, he looked at me.
Well, yeah, but he's a, you know, he's what, five?
In comparison, yes. In internet years, yes.
But with a lot of things, Paul, I've kind of realised that there's no point in thinking about retirement and what you might want to do, because basically I've got at least 10, probably 15 more years working, because that's just how it is. Get on with it. Yeah, I, 5 years ago, it seemed to be a thing. Oh, we're 45 years old. I should be thinking about the future and what I might want to do when I retire. But it's kind of like, don't think about it now. I don't want to.
We've all accepted none of us are ever going to retire.
Yeah, basically.
And I'm thinking about the future is pretty depressing at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Let's think about the past. Well, through rose-tinted glasses.
The golden age.
Yeah.
Exactly. Has anybody got any Werther's?
One at the bottom of my pocket, I think.
Yeah, that's good.
You know what I've been disappointed by recently? Do you remember those sweet peanuts that you used to get when a kid? They used to be like sweets, and they were shaped like monkey nuts.
Yep.
And they used to have little bits of ground up peanut on the inside. Not anymore, they don't. Not anymore.
It's an outrage.
They still shape like peanuts, but there's no peanut on the inside of the sweet peanuts.
Well, have you seen what they've done to the Toblerone?
Yes, that extra gap.
It's travesty.
Yeah,
I don't really like Toblerone, so I kind of don't care.
What about chocolate orange, though? They've taken a little chunk out of each slice now, and it just isn't the same.
Really?
What a fascinating podcast this is.
Isn't it just?
No. Whoa, I didn't know about the chocolate orange. That's...
I know. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to break it to you.
I'm hurt now.
Hang on, how does that work? Because then surely it's not...
It's like it's indented. The outside, the very final layer on the outside is the same, but everything else on one side of the slice is like indented. Trust me, just go and buy one and be disappointed.
I'm surprised how anybody's figured this out, because it's not yet Christmas Day, which is the only time it's legitimate to eat a chocolate orange.
No way. It's a staple for me.
Yeah, it's one of your five a day, eh, sir?
I love the idea that Sam lives off of chocolate oranges.
I don't drink too much, but boy, do I eat a lot of chocolate.
Does it go well with G&T? That's the question. Right, so there we go. We're going to retire to India or North Africa and have manservants look after us.
Just give up on everything. This is what you've got to look forward to, people.
It's all hopeless. So there we go. So should we talk about our first sponsor?
Who is our first sponsor this week, Paul?
Okay. No, I can't even be bothered to get enthusiastic about this. No, it's Videoblox.
Oh, great. Tell us about Videoblox, Paul.
Oh, piss off, Andy. Videoblox are paying for my retirement. That's all you need to know about them. So there we go. No, they're an affordable subscription-based stock media site. What does that mean? That means that they have loads of video footage, basically. So what you can do is you sign up for a monthly fee and you pay every month, but then you get access to as much video stock footage as you want. So all the kind of stuff that can be used to make videos that you produce to go on the website, etc. A lot more interesting. Saves so much time. You have no idea. As someone that uses them quite a lot, they're very useful. They've got a sister site called Audioblox as well, which is great for basically giving you the stock audio sounds that you need for, well, podcasts and things like this. You know, if you don't have a Marcus, and we don't all have an aging pop star to provide music for us, then Audioblox is the answer for you. You get unlimited downloads a month, great selection, over 115,000 videos, 130,000 audio files. And when I say 115,000 video files, this, you know, we're not talking about feature length movies here. We're talking about little clips that you can put into stuff. The average subscriber ends up paying less than $1 per download over a year, because, you know, you download so much stuff. You can download as much as you want. You can try it, see if it fits, if it works, if it doesn't matter. So there's a great variety of high quality video and audio to check out. They're always adding new stuff, and you've got unrestricted use to use it as much as you want. VideoBlox is offering listeners of this show a year's subscription to both VideoBlox and AudioBlox combined for only $149 for the year. And that's about $100 discount over the usual price tag. So it's definitely worth checking out. If you do any kind of video or audio work, then it's a really useful little tool. So it's videoblox.com/BoagWorld2016. Now, as we've already established, I'm retiring. So really, this whole discussion section is all down to Sam, because it was your idea to talk about this, Sam.
Yeah.
You came up with an extensive list of questions. So I'm now sitting back and handing the show.
Oh, great. Cheers.
Yeah, you're right with that? Is that right?
No problem at all.
So tell everybody what your idea was.
All right. So, I mean, it's relating to a really common question I get. I think we've talked about it briefly before, but it's always like, what is it like to work somewhere else? Ranging from digital agency size, type, small, medium, large. Also, what's it like to be on the agency side or the supplier side? But another common one I actually get, and I think it's becoming a bit more prevalent these days, and the primary topic is, you know, the differences really between in-house digital teams and digital agencies. So, mm-hmm. you know, really how anything from working at them to how it's affected business owners to what it's like to now work with companies that now have an in-house team. I know, Paul, you've got experience kind of getting transformations going within companies. Mm-hmm. There's just so much around this, like from, yeah, as I say, from hiring. Is there less work out there for business owners? Has it affected, I mean, one for Marcus maybe, has it affected the ability to grow projects into accounts because that need for an agency isn't so much there. What do we think about, is it a good idea to have in-house agencies? You know, what are we losing or gaining by that versus using an agency? I've got a ton more questions about it, but I mean, I'm really looking for anyone to get kicked off, because the truth is I've not really worked at an agency with clients for really 5 more years now. So I kind of knew what it was like back then, and I don't think it was too impactful. But in the last sort of 5-6 years, I've seen an awful lot of companies just sort of ditching all, if not most, of their suppliers because they're building their own in-house team. So, yeah, who wants to kick us off with that one?
Go on, Marcus. You must have something to say on this issue, running an agency as you do.
Well, in my experience, all in-house teams just
are shit.
Should be scrapped, basically. No, I'm joking.
Doesn't mean it.
I'm joking. I think that the honest truth, just to kind of go back to the question about work and is it affecting agencies, is yes, it is affecting agencies, and therefore there isn't as much work out there for agencies. So that's my kind of starting point. That said, it doesn't seem to be affecting us to the point that it's a problem at the moment. I think I mentioned it last week. 2 years ago, we had a really bad year. And at the time, it was kind of like, well, this is because, you know, all the kind of work we do is going in-house. Also at the time, I kept thinking that, and I always feel awkward saying this, that we were just kind of continually being unlucky during that year. We kept coming second on pitches and all this kind of thing. And I'm thinking, maybe it isn't the fact that work is going in-house, and maybe the fact that we, Headscape, had just had a bad year because we just kind of, you know, luck wasn't riding with us. And that has been borne out by this year, where it seems that every corner we turn, people just say, oh, can you do this for us? And can you do that for us? Whereas I don't expect that to keep going. But I think that my feeling that particularly bad year was down to bad luck, because this, you know, it's almost kind of bounced back on us this year in the opposite way. My experience of working with in-house teams is that for the most part, and I think this is because of the size of Headscape, we don't work with huge companies. I mean, there are a few exceptions to that. We work for Nestle, for example, who are obviously a very huge company, but they're kind of divided up into lots of different departments. And even though they have internal teams, they tend not to have teams that do design or coding, and they like to outsource that. But it seems that the level we're at, the in-house teams, even though they're growing, tend to be growing more towards content people, marketing people, rather than kind of design and coding type people. So as I say, at the kind of mid-level, if you like, that we tend to work at, it's not affected us badly yet. So it seems that we are still required. There is still a requirement for the expertise that we can bring to bolster the internal team, rather than us going, well, we keep going for a particular type of business and we keep getting pushed away because it isn't there. That doesn't make sense. So the gin and tonic's kicking in now. You know what I'm saying? There are still plenty of opportunities out there for a company of our size that's aiming where we're aiming, kind of mid-level.
So when you had that bad year, I was just curious, was it just, I guess, wrong instinct that you were attributing it to in-house teams getting the work? Well, or was it that you've had the strange situation that I've had in the past where I was pitching against an in-house team? I don't know if you've ever had that one.
No,
not for work against an internal team. Very bizarre.
Well, just to kind of put a little bit more detail on that bad year that we had, we had two opportunities that we felt, Paul will remember them very well, that we felt were absolute dead certs. Well, we'd been assured by the client that we were absolute dead certs.
In one case, we've been insured by the CEO of the company.
Wow.
Yeah.
You can't get better than that, can you?
And to add to that, they were both, they were the biggest projects we would ever have won if we'd won them, both of them. So it was kind of, if they both come in, it would have been the best year we'd ever had. And as it turns out, neither came in, and there was a certain expectation, obviously, when you're being told you're going to win this work, that they were going to happen. And when they didn't, it was kind of like, shit, how are we going to feed everybody?
But the fact that we'd got kind of reached that point where we were so reliant on those two big ones come in kind of does flag up whether there is an underlying issue there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think that what we did to make it so that now it's not an issue is get smaller.
Fired me, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you left us in our hour of need, Paul.
Oh, right. Okay, we're going with that. Fine. Sorry, I didn't know what we were going with today. Yeah, that's fine. I walked away from you in your hour of need. Yeah.
But I think that even though I say, and it's true, how much I am enjoying working at the moment with a smaller team and being much more involved in projects, though all of that is true, obviously we don't have to bring in as much work as we used to. Mm.
Andy, sorry, Marcus.
No, carry on.
I'm just interested in Andy, because Andy, you were saying that you were having a worse time of it more recently. You were finding it harder at the moment to bring in work. I think you were saying that last week, and I haven't just said something I shouldn't have. Do you attribute that to the growth of in-house teams?
No, I don't think our bad year has necessarily been to do with the fact that work is going in-house, and I think work is going in-house. I put our bad year down to, a bunch of factors that are probably in my control in terms of how we present things and, my lack of, enthusiasm, maybe even for going out and getting work this year, if I'm being honest. But things have changed over the last few years, and I am absolutely convinced that there is less work out there generally for agencies because, the clients, the larger, the discerning clients that we like to work with, they have more people in-house. Mm. And the jobbing web designers or agencies do we still call people full service? Would you describe Headscape as full service in terms of...
I prefer Headcase much more, Andy.
Right.
No is the answer to that. It depends what you mean by full service. We don't do print and stuff like that, so from that point of view, I guess we're not.
But you'll do design and you do build and you'll do UX and you'll do all of that stuff, so I would consider that to be potentially kind of full service. So I'm convinced that there's less work out there for larger companies or people doing that kind of thing because people are building in-house teams. And, these things are cyclical. We've seen this before. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden people find that they're not getting they're not getting the creative inspiration of new blood and all this kind of stuff. So, it's always cyclical. But what's been interesting, I think for me anyway, over the last sort of year or so, and this is something that I've been talking to our business advisor, Chris, about making into a thing, you know, actually presenting this in a way which hopefully people will say, cool, didn't realize you did this, is, you know, I really like to work on creative and art direction, that kind of leadership stuff. That's what I like to do best. And what I've found over the last, you know, even the last year or so, is that when we talk about in-house teams, they don't tend to include that role. You'll find that clients will, they'll see the value, or they have seen the value in bringing UX in-house. There'll be development teams, and there'll probably be some, no disrespect to anybody intended, low-level visual designers, pixel pushers, you know, doing grunt work, making interfaces, that kind of thing. But what they lack is the overall creative vision that kind of matches up with what maybe the marketing department or the branding people do. That kind of, you know, real kind of high level creative stuff. And that's what I do. So I've been going into in-house teams over the last sort of year or so and adding that role. And in fact, people have hired me to come in and do that kind of stuff because there is a lack of people that are willing to go out there and do it. And, you know, whether that's kind of actually just working with people in house, going there like I did with, you know, clients this year and spending 3 days a week on site, actually, you know, mentoring their designers and working with them, or doing consulting stuff. I mean, it was interesting when I was in Australia. Did I mention, Paul, I've been in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, once or twice, about as much as I've mentioned I've been in to India recently.
And, you know, I got hired for a couple of consulting gigs to talk about design systems and style guides and that kind of thing for a couple of big companies. And when I went there, it turned out that it wasn't what most people would think of as a style guide or a pattern library that they really, really needed. What they needed was a creative vision that binds everything together. You know, documenting a bunch of patterns, not enough. They needed something much more than that, and that's what I kind of did. So I think that there's an opportunity for people, hopefully people like me, to work with in-house teams rather than competing with them because, you know, I do stuff that people aren't hiring.
So in that company, Andy, I mean, did they not have, you know, senior creative people who would do this, you know, when you weren't there? What was the gap or the reason that they brought you in versus using in-house people?
Well, this is really interesting. I was working with a big newspaper in Australia, and on the print side of the floor, they have, you know, creative directors, they have art directors, right. They put a lot of money and time into, you know, the way that the Sunday magazine still looks in the normal way. But what I found really interesting was that at this particular company and some others that I visited, the website falls under the, in inverted commas, product team. And the product team is made up of UX people, generally, project managers and product designers. And to be honest, they're all just a bit boring. And they do a different job. I shouldn't be disrespectful to product people, but, you know, they do a different job. They have a different outlook on design than I do when it comes to, you know, the high level creative stuff. So the simple answer to your question is no, they don't. They haven't valued design before. They haven't valued, I mean, they've valued it in terms of UX, whatever that means, but, you know, they haven't valued the sort of high level creative thinking and, you know, what does this actually mean to how we communicate, blah, blah, blah. Until sort of fairly recently. And I think that a lot of people are realizing that, you know, the products that they make and the websites that they make are looking dull. We talked about this last week. And, you know, they need people like me to come in and help. And that, you know, that's a good thing.
I think a lot of it comes to the digital maturity of the organization.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
That you're talking about. Because, you know, I work with a lot of fairly large organizations that have in-house teams, and they have in-house teams because there is ongoing digital work that needs doing, ongoing, you know, digital touch points that users interact with that they need to support. But all of those teams tend to be what I would consider maintenance teams. that their job is to maintain what is already there. And they're resourced accordingly. So typically those kinds of teams consist of content people, developers, maybe one or two designery UX-y people, but not a huge amount, to be honest. And that's it, really. And the vision and the leadership comes from elsewhere in the organization. And I say vision in the very loosest sense of the word, more of an ad hoc, you know, kind of knee-jerk response to stuff. So, yes, they have internal teams, but these teams tend to be massively under-resourced. They don't have the authority that they need to bring about real change. And as a result, you know, they're never really doing much more than just firefighting and kind of day-to-day stuff, which is massively frustrating for the people that are working in these teams. And so I think where value from people like Andy or indeed myself come from is that we're almost brought in to do this take a step back kind of work, to look at the bigger picture, because they don't have time to do it themselves. And it's not even they don't have the capability to do it themselves. They just do not have the time.
So it's part of your remit ever to train these people that, well, hopefully will have the time for that and actually not need someone like yourself in the future, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's where you should get to. But the truth is that they do need some training. Absolutely. But they're knowledgeable people. They know their stuff to the most part. They tend to be a little bit behind because the organization hasn't invested in their training, because they see digital and user experience as a cost to the business rather than as a potential revenue generator. So they tend to underinvest in it, both in terms of staffing levels and also in terms of training. So they tend to be a little bit behind, but they're knowledgeable, clever people. The problem they've got, and probably their weakest area, is they're not very good salespeople. Yeah. They're not very good at selling digital, selling user experience, selling design into senior management. Yeah. And so often the biggest benefit that I personally provide, I think, is to convince senior management to invest more in building up their in-house team. But then that throws up interesting questions about, well, is that really the right way to
go? Exactly, yeah.
But first of all, Marcus, you look like you want to say something on the issue, because I do want to get onto that. Is it the right thing to do?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that by saying that we still get hired, probably the majority of projects, to basically get things done that the internal team already know what they need. You know, we are hired as the expert.
And as the additional resource, because
absolutely, yeah,
you know, they're not resourced up with this idea of continual iteration and investment in a website. Mm. You know, their teams are resourced up really to do the bare minimum of kind of content maintenance, not evolution of the website. So the website decays and decays and decays over a number of years until somebody in senior management throw their toys out of the pram and they hire somebody like Headscape to come in and redesign it, which must be immensely frustrating for the internal team.
I don't think that doesn't happen that often. It tends to be more how I just described it, that the internal team or the head of marketing or whoever that we're dealing with knows that something needs to happen, but they need to have a group of people like us to make that happen. Mm. And I suppose what I'm saying here is that one day we will be out of business agencies, because everyone will eventually catch up. I suppose the only thing that I've got to hang on to as far as people still needing us is we're more likely to be ahead of the curve of an internal team, because we're working with so many different clients and so many different issues come up that we're as a team, we're more likely to be a kind of ahead of that particular curve. And also that I think that some people like to outsource. But I think it's quite a depressing thought, really. But I think at the moment, the reason why I'm kind of like saying the things I was saying earlier along the lines of that there is plenty of work out there, is because it's a massive transitional period at the moment.
Yeah.
Where a lot of the, you know, people say they've got internal teams, but they're not very well they haven't got the right people, or they've got a lot of this particular type of skill, but they haven't got any of that. And we can kind of just fill in the gaps as well as, you know, making things happen.
I mean, there's also, don't forget, there's going to be the element where, you know, internal teams are always going to need specialists in very particular areas that you can't justify having a full-time person for. So there will be that kind of work. And there will always be that we've only got so much work we can take on as a team. And, you know, and so they may need additional resources from time to time. Whether they go to agencies for that kind of work or go to individual freelancers is up for debate. Andy, you look like you want to say something.
No, and I don't know whether it's because, you know, I've done a bit of speaking here and there and, you know, written a couple of books, but I do find that when I get brought in to work with teams quite often, I'm there as some sort of authority in a way to help them fight battles that they can't quite fight themselves. So the fact that I can come in and I can say something, which, you know, maybe they wouldn't dare to say to their boss or their management themselves, or, you know, I can be quite blunt about something which is lacking or not being done correctly or whatever. And I think people find that external authority quite, useful. Sometimes the trick is, I think, and what I like to try to do is to build people up so that they're confident to be able to do that kind of thing themselves.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, the whole idea behind, you know, doing what we do, I suppose, is to make ourselves redundant ultimately. But, you know, that's kind of part of the fun because, you know, we're moving on to something else. So I wouldn't worry too much about that.
And did you find yourself in those roles that you're spending your time? You talk about giving the, I guess, the credibility or whatever it is that they're lacking to get to have progress. But do you find yourself sort of guiding those teams on how to communicate with non-technical, non-creative, non-digital people? Because I find myself doing that an awful lot.
That's my biggest part of my job. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, Andy.
Yeah, pretty much all the time.
Right.
And that, you know, to be honest, that's the bit that I kind of like most because, you know, I like teaching.
I do.
And I like, you know, workshopping and doing all of that kind of stuff. And, yeah, actually helping people to do that is, like, it's part of the best bit.
Yeah, agreed.
Before we – I do want to get into this issue of whether or not an in-house team is actually a good idea. Because I've got my opinions, but I've had some very good counter arguments that have been quite impressive. But before we get into that, I'm quite interested, Drew, from you, you've probably got a better overview of the industry than almost we have, because you have these clients, you have a lot of different clients coming to you in a lot of different situations, you know, and just from the sales of perch licenses alone, you must get a sense of whether they're mainly being bought by agencies these days or in-house teams or how agencies are doing. I'm kind of, what are you seeing?
Yeah, we definitely see a mix of agencies and in-house teams. It's probably predominantly agencies.
Right.
But certainly from a sort of tech support point of view, there's a very clear trend that we see when people are using the software in-house.
Yeah.
In that there's often very little continuity between staff members.
Mm.
So we'll frequently have people coming and asking us questions. They've not used our system before. And they're new to a job and they need to understand how to do things. And none of the knowledge has been passed across. Particularly, I think, at the sort of smaller scale of the market, where you're sort of thinking of rather than web teams of 8 or 12 or 16 or whatever, where you've got web teams that are maybe one or two people, maybe a manager and then somebody they've hired out of, you know, straight out of university. You know, perhaps the business has looked at what they're spending with an agency every year and thought, well, for that, we can hire a graduate to be with us full time.
Yeah.
They could just do this stuff nonstop. But what you tend to get in that scenario is you get people who are, if they're, you know, they're in the early stages of their career, they come into a job, they do some stuff, they learn some skills, and then they want to move on to the next, you know, take the next step. So you get a lot of changeover. And so we find that, we get people who are having to maintain a site and all the knowledge that was built up while that site was being implemented has been completely lost. And I don't think that's a problem you get so much with an agency. I mean, of course you get turnover of staff within an agency, but you also have, more continuity as a company, and you have the agency working on lots of different projects, often using, you know, similar solutions, like they'll standardize on a framework or a CMS or what have you. And so if as a business you're going back to that agency, they're going to have people on staff who know what system that you're running, and you're going to get more continuity. I mean, it's certainly something we saw when we were doing client work. I mean, we had one particular client where, as an external agency for them, we'd been there longer than any of their staff. And we knew more really about certain parts of their business than anybody on staff did.
Yeah.
You know, just because they were using us as an external resource, we were there and we'd had that built up knowledge. So yeah, it's certainly a factor. And I guess there are ways to solve that. But what you tend to have in these smaller teams with people who are early on in their career is that lack of experience to know that they need to make sure that everything's documented and they have handover processes to go between, you know, to whoever comes along next to do. Because, you know, why should they know? They've not done that before unless they've got a manager telling them exactly you must do this. Mm-hmm.
But also, even if they do know, oftentimes they don't have the time to document stuff. You know, they're constantly being pushed to do ever more things with ever limited resources.
I've been in that scenario myself. In fact, when I started off my very first job, I was kind of the web guy. I was like the webmaster within a software company.
Yeah.
And I would like spend Monday running Perl scripts to analyze web blogs to produce a weekly report of analytics. And then Tuesday I would implement what the marketing department wanted, you know, and you would fall into that maintenance role. And I think particularly, I mean, we were talking about having, agencies come in with, sort of external expertise, to teach or to apply. But I think another crucial thing that agencies bring is external perspective.
Yeah.
Because when you're within a company, within a business, working on the same things day in, day out, sometimes you just can't see the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
And it's the reason that, you know, in all types of, you know, business managers will have like management consultants who come in. It's not because they don't know how to manage their business, but they're just sometimes you're so deep into it, you need somebody with external perspective to say, look, this thing you're doing is wrong. You should be doing that.
Which I guess leads us into, you know, in-house teams or not, because one of the benefits is kind of similar to what you just mentioned. So the external view is always good, but one of the advantages of having an in-house team is that they know your business, your brand, your values, mm-hmm. Everything that goes into providing a solution. And that's one benefit, but Paul, you talked about, you know, some opinions of yourself, maybe not such a good idea.
Well, it's interesting because I almost always recommend it.
Okay.
You know, when I talk to organizations, I say, look, you know, increasingly digital, and it is becoming business critical to organizations. And, you know, you wouldn't take another business critical component and outsource it to a third party organization, right? It's inherently risky to do that because the outside organization may go away, and there are all kinds of potential risks associated with taking something that is business critical and outsourcing it. So my kind of default position has always been, yeah, all right, you know, you need to build up an in-house team, but that, there are some concerns that go along with it. And Drew has hit one on the head, I think, very much with this idea that you can't see the wood for the trees. Now, I talk a lot about people becoming institutionalized.
Yeah.
That because user experience and digital is still relatively new within the lifetime of some organizations, it gets bolted on to existing processes and existing thinking. Mm-hmm. So people end up self-censoring themselves. You know, they end up saying, oh, well, we don't do things that way here. You know, and that's a dangerous road to go down when the whole landscape has changed around you, when the business environment has changed around you, to suddenly then turn around and say, well, we don't do things like that is very dangerous. And actually what you need to implement a culture that is user centric and is digital by default is people that are going to be disruptive, is people that are going to cause trouble. And it's a lot easier to cause trouble from the outside than it is from the inside, if that makes sense.
It is. I mean, do you think that's because, in my experience, yes, the culture needs work, but the people, especially in bigger companies who've been there 20 years or whatever, they still tend to think of digital as, let's say, computers. And that just happened. Is that as prevalent as I imagine?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You know, the example that I always talk about, which I think seems to click with a lot of people, is I talk about how ubiquitous electricity is, mm-hmm. right? And I say that in the early days of electricity, when electricity first came along, people had chief electricity officers, right? So you would go to someone to get permission to use electricity. And everybody goes, oh, that's ridiculous. How silly. And they all sneer like you just did. And yet that's the reality we're living in today. You know, that there's this kind of digital team, these techies, that do techie things with digital, and you have to go to the techie team and you have to ask them to do something digitally. Mm-hmm. But I think that in time is going to change so that digital is ubiquitous, and to outsource that is very hard to do, because then there's always a distance. There's always a barrier between it. But the flip side of that, something that Rob Borley, who's been on this show, said to me once, which I thought was very interesting, is that, yeah, that's all well and good theoretically, you know, in the future, in this lovely new utopia. But right here and now, the reality is that most organizations don't know how to manage digital, don't know how to create a good user experience, and most importantly of all, don't know how to run good digital teams mm-hmm. and look after good digital people. So as a result, when people do build internal teams, they're often frustrated and constrained by politics and bureaucracy and that kind of stuff. So actually maybe having a kind of a separate, you know, organization with their own structures, their own ways of working mm-hmm. that acts as your digital team might be the better way to go.
I've seen that done a few times. It was effective in some places, not in others. I mean, of the successes you've had, I guess, in that role, what do you think I'm really fascinated to how you changed people's opinion of digital, how you got them to buy into what we know as a good way of working, but what is so alien to so many other people.
I mean, the way that I know this, look, Andy and Marcus have both got their hands up. They're waiting patiently, but I don't give a shit. It's my show.
Thought it was my show today.
Oh, that's true. And also, it's Marcus's,
my show,
I guess,
too.
Go on then, Marcus. You say what you want to, and we'll come back to that point in a minute, because you had your hand raised the longest.
It was.
You're a very good boy.
It was, as a kind of extension of that, really, in the fact that, and we've said this before, that if you're part of a team that's only working on one thing, then that's likely to be less rewarding than if you're working as part of a team where you're working on lots of different things. So,
I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, all right. Then you can say that some people want some things and other people want other things. I think, all right, I'm going to say that no offense meant at all, but I'm guessing, and I'm treading very carefully here, that somebody who's very good at what they do is more likely to want lots of challenges and therefore would prefer the agency model, possibly. But my concern there, therefore, is that if an internal team may struggle to keep hold of people, and therefore you're going to have lots of churn, and therefore just adds to all the things we were talking about earlier, you know, it's hard to manage a team, especially if it's all different people changing all the time because they think, actually, you know, I want to be working for that fancy agency down the road where I can get experience of doing lots of different types of project. I don't know if that's necessarily true or not, but it was a valid point.
I think the counter that I've seen to that is that some people want to not worry about the repetition that comes with some client work, depending on which agency you're at. I know for a fact that when I was working agencies and had the opportunity to go to a sort of one product or, you know, a couple of product environment, my biggest fear was repetition at the product company. You know, how long can one or two products keep me interested? I was completely surprised to find that the variety of work that you had to do on that product was actually, for me anyway, far more varied than the sort of agency life that I'd had that tended to be churning out similar end results.
I'm just referring to the utopia that is Headscape, obviously.
Andy, you're champing at the bit.
No, you always say I'm chomping at the bit. I'm sitting here quite patiently. Now, okay. I was thinking that, I mean, possibly, I hope, we would all agree that it's better to work alongside people. If you are an agency or you're a freelancer or, you know, a small company like mine, it's best to work alongside the people that you're working with in terms of in-house teams and clients rather than having one of these relationships, which is very much kind of like, you know, vendor and client.
Yeah.
You know, where you're just kind of throwing stuff over the wall and going, dunno, done my job.
Hear, hear.
The problem, though, is that the way that most clients, or a lot of clients, particularly when it comes to larger organizations or government or some, you know, institutions or another, the way that they actually go about hiring an external source does not make it very easy to establish that kind of relationship, because you know, you've got bullshit tendering processes that are based on you know, point systems and all of that kind of shite. Well, you know, maybe this is a topic for another day. I'm sure Marcus and I could talk for a long time.
I was just about to say, we can fill a whole podcast with this.
Well, maybe what we should do is we should talk in another episode about how you can write a great brief, how you can commission people. You know, we can, you know, maybe it's not a topic for today, but I think that what is a good point is that we still need to, whether we're in agencies or not, foster good relationships with clients on the inside and in-house teams, because it's very difficult, and it's very, you know, it would be very easy for me to go into a client where they've got, you know, a couple of designers and some UX people or whatever and alienate them. You know, if I'm being brought in as, like, you know, an authority, and I'm, and it's very, very, you've got to tread a very fine line between getting the job done in a way which is obviously going to produce the best work and making sure that you don't alienate the people that on the inside that have maybe been there for a while, that think that, well, who are you coming in? You know, we've been here 2 years. We know the business much better than you are.
Very good point.
You do. So I think that's one of the things that is difficult from my point of view.
Well, the first thing I always do when I go into companies and is I will sit, as soon as I possibly can, I sit down with the internal web team and I say, okay, what have you been saying for 3 years and no one's listened to? And then I repeat that. Because I'm the external consultant and because management can see my costs much more transparently, therefore they value me more highly, which is wrong, but it's the reality, then they do tend to listen to me over their own internal teams, which is horribly depressing, but it's the reality of it. But going back to the point you were saying about procurement, that kind of brings us back, actually, believe it or not, to the question that Sam asked me, which was, how do you get around a lot of these problems? How do you establish a different culture? Because the culture has to touch everything all the way through to procurement and how you procure external digital experts. One of the things that I found that works the best is actually to form, and call them this as well, to form an innovation team within an organization. A cross-disciplinary team made up of marketing people, of digital people, UX people, developers, everybody you need. And if you call them an innovation team, it's code within larger organizations for we're ignoring all the rules, right? And so by creating an innovation team, you're basically creating within the company a little startup. And that startup, you know, doesn't have to wait 3 weeks for a printer because IT has to come and fit it All right.
Yeah.
They don't have to go through the normal procurement process. They don't have to, go through risk assessment in the same way because they're an innovation team. They work differently. So they can then create this little bubble within the organization that's a different culture, a different way of working, you know, that's agile, that's user centric, that's digital first, et cetera, et cetera. Then what you do is as they work on these things, you bring into that team product owners, business specialists from across the organization. So let's say you're working on product X and product X's digital footprint. So what you do is you bring in someone from the product X team and embed them in your innovation team, in that group of people that's going to deliver on the digital component of Product X. And that Product X representative is living and breathing and experiencing the culture of that little team. He's being inspired and excited by the potential of what can be done if you don't do things the way they've always been done. Mm-hmm. You're not constrained by procurement rules. You're not constrained by this and that and the other. And then at the end of the project, and also they're exposed to just how amazing, you know, agile can be, just how great it can be working from a user-centric point of view. And then they go back to their department and they take that culture with them and you infect the rest of the organization.
It's a good word, culture. But I understand that.
Yeah. So it is, it's almost like a viral infection, that the innovation team becomes this viral infection within the company that slowly spreads. I mean, it's a marathon and not a sprint, but it can work. And the key to it is having really a strong leader of that innovation team. Where I've seen it work in the past, there's been someone who has got the authority, well, not even the authority, but just the gumption to say, we're going to do things differently. We're going to ignore the procurement process. Come after me if you've got a problem with that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's having people that are willing to do that that I think is so important. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we could carry on this subject. I can't believe we're at 55 minutes already. And I feel like we've only touched the surface of this.
There's definitely more, yeah.
Is there anything that anybody else wanted to really bring up before we wrap up today? We can always revisit this another week.
No, it would be interesting to find out what listeners think on this subject as well, because, you know, we're in a small little bubble here, the five of us. So it would be very interesting to find out what people who are actually out there working on in-house teams are experiencing.
Yeah, so definitely let us know either on the comments in the show notes or on Twitter or whatever. I think this is a conversation worth continuing on. But we'll wrap up for this week. If for no other reason than we need to do a different subject next week that Drew is able to join in on more as the only person that doesn't have to endure the agency or in-house life. You are a unique being in your own right, Drew.
I like to think so.
Yeah. All right. So let's quickly just say a couple of words about our second sponsor, which is Vivaldi.
Oh, yes. Talk about Vivaldi, Paul.
I'm not going to. They are going to talk about themselves and how great they are. Now, because Molly, as you will have heard last week's show, is one of the people behind Vivaldi. And when we were talking about it, I thought, look, just you guys talk about it instead. You tell us why Vivaldi is an interesting browser. So here is the stuff from the guys at Vivaldi.
Hey, everyone. It's Molly here from Developer Relations at Vivaldi Browser, Vivaldi.com. You might remember me from the bad old days of the web browser wars, the Web Standards Project, and maybe you might have read a book or two. I've spent my career advocating for a free and open web that puts people first, whether it be through the user experience, accessibility, and most passionately and notably, to ensure that browsers implement the things we want and need. I also spent many years as an invited expert to the W3C, especially in the CSS working group. This is why I cannot imagine being anywhere else than here at Vivaldi Browser, and here's why. Our interface is being built using HTML, CSS, SVG, JavaScript, and open web technologies, making it super easy for any of us with these common core skills to turn it into a powerful driver of our websites, our applications, and even extended technologies as we move forward into the Internet of Things and a brave new world. Here's the important message, though. We're here for you. We are you. We are a small group of passionate people with the leadership and resources to make something awesome and lasting for and with this industry, to embrace the best practices of inclusive design and user-first ideologies. So please download our recent 1.5 release at Vivaldi.com and let us all know how we can grow better together.
So there you go. There's a bit about Vivaldi. You can find out more about them at boag.world/betterbrowser. Right, so that about wraps it up for this week's show. I hope you guys found it useful. We'd be really interested, as Andy said, to hear your opinions, whether you're from the in-house side or the agency side. And by the way, if you work in-house and want to send hate mail to Marcus, it's marcus@boagworld.com. He really did mean to imply that you were less motivated and less inspired as a designer developer.
Oh, that's right, dear. Marcus. That's not what I was saying.
That's how I read it.
Yeah.
Certainly was. So where can people find out about you and reach out to you, Marcus, in case they want to for some reason?
Hire Headscape at headscape.co.uk.
So hang on, you've just insulted internal teams and now that you want people. Them to hire you. You are right, Mark. I think there are different personality types between people that tend to work at agencies and people who tend to work in-house. But it's like anything, isn't it? It's not black and white. And you weren't saying it was black and white. Of course, no, you weren't.
I was not. Bad man.
I'm a very bad man. I like to stare at Andy. What about you? Where can people find out about you?
Well, people can hire me. Because I'm much nicer and more collaborative than Marcus, obviously.
Yeah.
At stuffandnonsense.co.uk, or you can DM me or tweet me at Malarkey.
And Drew, where can people buy your stuff?
They can find me on Twitter at Drew M, and they can buy my stuff at grabaperch.com.
And Sam, you've got nothing to offer the
As
world.
I always say, Percy Pigs or, you know, anything like yeah. that. I mean,
or pictures of cats.
Yes, yes. Follow me on Twitter at the Sam Barnes if you like cats. I wouldn't bother if you don't. That's pretty much all it is these days.
Yeah. And I tell you, your Instagram feed makes me nauseous. Every Friday you go into the cats.
It's Saturday, every other Saturday at the moment, yeah. I did think about including a hashtag to allow people to mute, but you know what? Unfollow me.
I don't want to.
Exactly. I'm testing you. Are you my real friend or not?
I'm torn between the two. Yeah. My hatred of cats and my love of Sam Barnes. Very difficult.
And my website is thesambarnes.com.
Are you still blogging much there, Sam? Because you should be.
I should be. And the honest truth is I haven't really done much since I started speaking. Because it takes a lot out of me personally, and it's the kind of thing I say, right, no more talking, I'll get back to writing, and then something comes along that sounds something like I want to be a part of. So,
right.
Yeah.
Sam, I'm hereby commanding you to blog more.
Okay.
Make it happen. You can even write something for Boag World if you feel so inclined.
Never ending with you, isn't it? Never ending.
I'm just such a giver.
Uh-huh.
Getting you to write for me
so
for
much.
Free. Yeah. All right, Marcus, have you got a joke for us?
I have. This is from the Boag World Slack channel. And I had to dig back deep. So it's one that I probably skipped over before, setting this up beautifully.
Yeah, you're really selling it.
It's from Anders Grenstadback.
Is that a real name?
Made-up name.
Grenstadback. I don't think he's from England.
No shit.
Here's the joke. I hate elevators, and I take steps to avoid them.
That's I quite like that one. kind of appeals to me, that one.
Oh, there you go.
Sam, I thought you'd walked out on me then. You disappeared.
I did. Something went wrong. Then I reloaded. I'm back. I've got a rather scary warning message I'll tell you about in a minute. But
that doesn't sound good. I don't like the sound of that at all. Okay, that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, guys. Don't forget to check out our Christmas appeal, and especially if you run an agency or if you've got clients, basically. If you send out Christmas cards to clients, go to boag.world/Xmas, and you'll find a good reason why you should. But until next week, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Come on. Bye.